With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Matt Davis Adams, and this is Parts Unknown, the podcast that wears a fanny pack and a pink jumpsuit to a wedding because, well, why wouldn't you? It's the 22nd Mania we've put under the microscope, and it features one of the most iconic matches and finishes in wrestling history, the double turn in the submission bout between Bret Hart and Stone Cold Steve Austin. Here to break it all down is the meanest and streetest posse this side of Connecticut, Dr. Death Carrie Dunn.
Hello.
The matron of domination, Anton Tolui.
Hello there.
And Carl Beaver Cleavage Anchor.
What a rush!
I can see why you struggled to get through that intro.
So here we are back in 1997 at the Rosemont Horizon in Chicago, and uniquely for a Mania, it's not a sellout. In exciting news, it's another sub-3-hour show, which is good because most of the card is pretty poor. In less exciting news, it's JR, Lawler and Vince on comms. There are a lot of manoeuvres tonight, but it's his last Mania calling the action. We have to start with Bret against Austin then. Special guest ref in this, Ken Shamrock, who looks amazing in his Lycra ref outfit and Reebok pumps. I know I can pull that off. I think we all could, actually, to be fair. Carl, you're the wrestling historian among us.
Right. Okay. This is all Shawn Michaels' fault. So Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart tear the house down in the Iron Man match at WrestleMania 12. Shawn Michaels wins.
Tore your house down, maybe. We'll speak about that next week.
The plan was Bret Hart, they'll have a rematch at WrestleMania 13. Shawn Michaels, in between this time, loses his smile and has a knee injury, disappears from the product. Bret Hart is injured somewhere in between, returns to WWE, and basically WWE's changing. Both in storyline, out of storyline. The WCW is maintaining a great lead in the Monday Night Wars. Vince McMahon is very, very scared that WWE will put out of business. During this point in time, they're going, we need to change the product, refresh it. Oh, look, there's this very interesting gentleman over here called Stone Cold Steve Austin, who's got this anti-authoritarian thing, drinking lots of beer, middle fingers. Bret Hart doesn't like that. Bret Hart believes wrestling should be an art form and should be about moves and should be a violent dance, but no one should be particularly hurt. Whereas there are different elements in here. Bret voices these views, is more or less turned down by both Vince McMahon and the crowd as a whole. And then it basically builds to this feud where you've got Bret Hart, both in real life and in wrestling, thinking wrestling's gone too far and we need to bring back the dignity to wrestling. And there has to be more respect, and we need to review this as an art form. And then you've got Stone Cold, very much in wrestling storyline, going nuts to all that. It's all about being the best and being the individual and being there for yourself. So you get this amazing match where Bret Hart and Stone Cold aren't so much fighting. They're not fighting for a title, which is said a lot in commentary. They're fighting for something else, which pretty much seems to be supremacy over each other in forms of what is the greatest idea of what wrestling should be?
Well, the future of the industry.
Yeah.
But I mean, I didn't want to answer your question flippantly because it could have been the slow dismantling of Bret Hart, which I think could have been the answer to we'll talk about the match and you can probably get to why that could be pertinent. But during Carl's exceptionally eloquent answer, I could just see Carrie's heart eyes emoji sort of throughout the whole thing. I know she should talk more about this because you are the heart expert.
And Austin had made no secret of the fact that he wanted Bret's ass, and it was good for us all that he did get it. And they started with that typical Austin-like wild brawl element to the match. And then you mesh into that the in-ring technicianship of Bret, and it was like a perfect marriage.
Yeah. Carl's kind of talking about the heart kind of platonic ideal of wrestling, the violent dance, which I liked. But the other thing about Bret is he talked quite a lot about wanting to use blood sparingly, if ever. And that's another thing, kind of the level of spectacle, I think, is another kind of contrast that needs to be kind of drawn here. And as Carl was talking, I was kind of thinking, the spectacle element of WWF and WWE is starting to increase at the same time. Something else that Bret Hart objected to hugely. And obviously the nadir of that spectacle was something that had a very tragic end on a pay-per-view that affected the Hart family particularly. So I guess this is kind of where that kind of, as Anton said, the slow dismantling of Bret Hart as kind of one of the main linchpins does begin, despite the fact that this match is a glorious and a triumph and I love it. It's also kind of a foreshadowing of what comes next in the next 2 or 3 years.
You mentioned the blood and the blade there. Interesting that it's Bret who was sort of insistent on that. There was a no blood rule in the company at this time, but they had a chat, the two of them, before, and Bret said, look, A, I can do this for you. Don't do it yourself. I can do it safely. But B, I'll take the heat that we will get for this. And Vince, on commentary, this is unfortunate. It doesn't happen often in the World Wrestling Federation. He was trying to cover up for it, but it gave us arguably the most iconic in-ring image in the history of the WWF, with Stone Cold covered in blood at the end.
Which is another really fascinating thing, because Bret was also so absolutely adamant he did not want other people to cut him. He would always advise other people not to let the person they were in the ring with to do the blading for them. He always said, if you're going to blade, you must do it yourself, because you can't trust another guy to do it for you.
Also, the blood needed to be there, which is a weird thing to say, to make the finish more believable, because Austin passes out because he's lost blood and he just can't take, you know, the pain is just, everything is just, body just shuts down, which is more believable when you see this guy and this just this crimson mess in the middle of the ring. So, you know, as much as I don't like this, you know, as much as, I can't say I don't like to, because there is that part of me which doesn't mind it. I don't mind seeing responsible bleeding, if that's a thing. But yeah, I think it did need it for the narrative of the match and to add that extra element to make it a classic.
And Carl, talk us through how they actually did the double turn at the end. So we've spoken about the image of Austin passing out bloody. Shamrock calls the match off, doesn't he? He says Austin can't carry on, so Austin never quits. And then
The interesting thing is, it's not just at the end. So the match starts at a frenetic pace. They do that weird Austin brawling, I just need to get on top of you energy, where they're just beating each other up. And the story is, the story at the start is, you get classic Bret Hart, which is, I'm chopping down your legs to set up the sharpshooter, which he often does with bigger opponents. So he targets a lot of the knees, targets a lot of the hamstrings, does all of that. It's not really working, because Stone Cold every now and again will just, in Bret Hart's eyes, cheat or do something more akin to fighting rather than wrestling. So there's a bit particularly where Bret Hart's doing a lot on Stone Cold's legs on the outside of the ring, and Stone Cold just grabs his tights, pulls them towards him, and throws them towards some steel steps.
It's really interesting, you hear JR shouting, not like this, at various junctions in that match as well, to get behind what Hart is trying to achieve.
Yes.
So it was a submission match as well, we should point that out, and that was something that Austin was slightly concerned by, wasn't it, because he didn't have a submission move.
He didn't,
himself.
But he threw in a Boston Crab and a very interesting Rings of Saturn-like move. So the story is, Bret Hart is trying to wrestle a fighter, and he cannot. Bret Hart can't do it his way, and is slowly succumbing to the dark side, and is brawling more, and he's using more weaponry. So there's a particular bit where Stone Cold tries choking him out using electrical cord, and Bret Hart hits him over the head with the ring belt, and then he attempts the sharpshooter. That's where Stone Cold doesn't pass out. He wins the match, and then he returns and goes back to the ring and begins to beat up Stone Cold some more. In between all this, the crowd is booing him, giving him middle fingers. Bret Hart, for the very first time, is giving middle fingers back to the crowd, and is basically going, screw you, you don't care about me, I don't care about you. Attacks Stone Cold some more. Ken Shamrock gets involved. Ken Shamrock does a very weird, he does this quite often, which is like a, it's not quite a suplex, it's like a belly to belly thing. And then it looks as if Bret Hart is going to beat up Ken Shamrock, which is a huge thing, because it's Bret Hart attacking an authority figure, which is very much what Bret Hart does not do. You also have to bear in mind, Bret Hart's family's in the arena. So Stu Hart, his dad, I forget.
Helen
Hart is there as well. And Bret Hart's daughter is there as well. And so this is, again, the slow disillusion and dissolving of Bret Hart and what he stands for in this ring. And that you just get this man is fundamentally changed by this match. And it is as good as every single WWE best of matches will tell you, because the storyline is lightning in a bottle.
Yeah.
And Stone Cold was brilliant in the build with it. I loved his line of, you put the letter S in front of Hitman, you've had my exact opinion of Bret Hart. And it was that kind of thing that Bret really struggled with, wasn't it? Because he would go on to say things like, the whole of America's a toilet bowl. If you're going to stick the enema anywhere, it would be right here in Washington, D.C. And it just, it was almost like they were setting him up to fail at this point, wasn't it? Which kind of covered in Wrestling with Shadows.
Which is, we've said before that Bret is not the strongest promo man in the world. He's not necessarily a great actor, but when it comes to telling a story as a wrestler, he doesn't need to be able to speak because he can do all that without actually talking. He can tell the story with his wrestling, and I think this match is kind of an encapsulation of why I'm such a Bret Hart fangirl.
And such a shame that this was his, could have been his last WrestleMania, but then he came back and had that one with Vince that we talked about.
It never happened. Never happened.
But for me, I mean, I'm not a massive Bret Hart fan because of, in the ring, I'm not going to criticise, but in terms of like the promo skills, but also just the natural whininess. And it's almost as though WWF held a mirror to Hart and said, right, the crowd are turning, they want something else. So we're going to let them see what you give us every day while you're complaining to us about the direction of the product, the direction of our matches, direction of your character. Go on then, whine. Whine and complain and turn on the fans and turn on wrestling as a whole, and you will get booed out of the arena, and go and deal with that. And obviously he wasn't self-aware enough to pick up on that. And they basically just held a big mirror up to Bret Hart and said, right, there you go, we're going to sell you out.
We spoke about this before in that match that didn't happen, about how Bret Hart very much doesn't understand he is responsible for telling his own story. And if you leave it up to other people, they will paint you as XYZ. And the interesting thing about this match, and the interesting thing about why double turns are so hard to do, is because this isn't Bret Hart pretending to be anything. Bret Hart absolutely believes the product's going in the wrong way. Bret Hart absolutely does not like what Stone Cold Steve Austin stands for. Bret Hart very much believes the crowd and wrestling as a whole is rejecting him at the time. So a bit later on, you get the Montreal Screwjob. And he was doing this weird thing where, in Bret Hart's eyes, I was a heel in America, but a face everywhere else. I'm like, no, you're not. You're a heel everywhere. You can't. That's not a dichotomy that works. If you're a heel in one territory, you're a heel everywhere. Bret Hart fundamentally didn't understand that wrestling was changing and society was changing as a whole. And the very interesting thing I see now, I wrote down in my notes, Bret Hart is such a baby. He's such a whiner. He needs to get on with it and accept the world for as it is. The thing is, Bret Hart was right. And the more I watch modern day wrestling and the more I look around, there is, once you strip away dignity and you strip away the understanding that wrestling is meant to be a violent dance and no one's meant to be hurt, and there's greater things than just crass vulgarity. Once you understand, once you remember that, and if you take that all that out, you get so many of the problems you have with modern WWE. You get the problems with their Hall of Fame. You get the problems they have with where they're booking their pay-per-view events. You get the problems where you just, with what they had with women wrestlers and minority wrestlers, and how they just told awful homophobic stories. Like, wrestling evolved, and it needed to evolve, and it needed the Attitude Era, and it needed to change. But also, wrestling shouldn't have got rid of Bret Hart, and it shouldn't have got rid of Bret Hart's voice going, that's too far.
Because he failed to adapt as well. It's not just one way street. To say that Bret was, Bret was right in the end. Was he? Are we not taking a kind of putting Bret on a pedestal here and what he really stood for? Come on, he was also quite a selfish guy, always tried to look out for as much money as he could get on all this. This isn't some guy who just wanted to protect the sanctity of wrestling, and he wanted to protect himself as well. He wanted to protect his legacy, his family. This isn't just a sort of crusade for wrestling as a whole.
To be fair, and again, not saying that Bret is perfect, but I think he also kind of sees himself and the true legacy of proper wrestling as the same thing.
Is that defence? Or is that adding to my... I'm not sure which way around it is.
Both.
The answer is probably somewhere in the middle. At the point in time, WWE was being held, I don't want to say hostage, but the creative direction of WWE was in the hands of a whiny, piss-baby, coked-up man called Shawn Michaels, and a man in Vince McMahon who didn't understand anything that young people were interested in. And it moved left and right, and it veered off course and on course and didn't know what it was doing.
Whoa, did you not see the PlayStation blimp during this? Senior, he knew what young people wanted.
And the Attitude Era was needed and necessary and is viewed fondly by many people. But I think we did lose a lot by dismissing Bret Hart as a whiny baby rather than going, this guy has quite a few good points.
Yeah, he just kind of hamstrung himself in that, you know, if Carrie's the second biggest Bret Hart fan in the world, the first is Bret Hart. That was the problem, wasn't it, for him? I mean, his autobiography, really interesting historical document, but man, it's long. And there is a lot of chapters that finish with, needless to say, I had the last laugh. But it'd be nice if he could get back involved in some way in wrestling now, whether because of what's happened, he just doesn't want to anymore.
Yeah, if Alan Partridge was the greatest chat show host in the world, that would be akin to Bret Hart, wouldn't it, effectively? Bret Hart's one of the finest ring technicians ever, but he's Alan Partridge.
He was in The Simpsons, though, so that's pretty cool, isn't it? And he was a heel in The Simpsons, actually, taking Mr. Burns' house.
Watch Wrestling with Shadows. They describe him as wrestling's Hamlet. Basically, doesn't... A character in a tragedy cannot affect the storyline. Brutally tragic life, and brutally tragic, like, history.
But as Anton says, not whiter than white. You know, he had numerous affairs, which he made reference to. He's put out the odd homophobic tweet, which he's had to apologise for. And in Wrestling with Shadows, he compares things like the Montreal screw job to rape, which is just not really cool. But a great match. Make sure you watch it if you haven't watched it. It's one of the few matches around this time that, like, stands up to a modern day match, essentially, which is really, really difficult to do. And interesting that polar opposite characters, but on screen, but obviously two men who had a lot of respect for each other, and that helped make it work. But then it worked with Shawn Michaels when they hated each other. So maybe Bret is an absolute genius, and that's the common factor. We talked about that for an awful long time. It was the fifth match on this show. It was the longest match. It went just over 22 minutes. The main event, crikey Moses, I don't think we're going to be talking about it with as much reverence. The Undertaker beating Psycho Sid to win his second WWF Championship in a match famous for... Producer Ben's written this. Sid shitting his pants before he was placed in a tombstone, a really poor tombstone that it was too. Sean was on commentary for this. It was a no DQ match. Sean, as Carl has mentioned, had his knee injury where he'd lost his smile, so he wasn't wrestling this year. Sid did an awful pre-match interview with Todd Pettengill. Let's talk about Sid. Quiet shout promos. I've got half the brain that you have, that brilliant one. Stabbing Arn Anderson in a Blackburn hotel, breaking his leg horrifically. Quite the character, Carrie.
Yeah, and you really remember the leg break, which horrifies me and haunts my dreams. And I don't think...
Not on the WWE Network.
Is it not?
Because good.
Thank God.
It's not on the WWE Network. It's a horrific... he's in WCW... I think Russo's there at the time. I think it's 2000, and basically Russo says, I need you to start doing high-flying manoeuvres. He goes, I can't do them. He goes, I'll just try it. Does it, and breaks his leg horrifically on pay-per-view. Sorry, I've been the joke.
No, I'm just going to throw out quietly into my cup of tea. This match, it happened. It definitely happened.
But we can't throw all the blame Undertaker's way.
No, God,
this.
No. I know that I have been extremely derogatory towards Taker across this series, but no, this was not one that I'm going to pick on him for. This is just not a good match. We've talked before about the fact that we like our title matches to also be our main events, and that should theoretically marry up. But obviously... Hart Austin is your main event here. That's your biggest match. That's your best match. And nobody cares about the two matches that come after. And I definitely don't care about this match.
Well, Sid only got the belt a month before.
Yeah.
That's what says. There's no real... But he wasn't really in the title picture. Sort of much going in, and then all of a sudden gets the... So even as there's no real reason for these two to really be going at it. The best thing about this match is when Sid comes into the ring and there's a huge Sid in pyro above him. You're like, ooh, that's cool. If I walk, when I die, I want my coffin to come out. So,
Axel
above the ring. Why am I being married? Where am I being married?
Okay, fine, brother.
So Brett gets involved in this as well, doesn't he? Sean has a dig at him, Sean on commentary. Brett calls him a phony little faker with a pussyfoot injury. Brett comes down toward the end of the match. He hits Sid with a chair. Sean says, doesn't he ever get tired of getting beaten up? The fact that they were basically burying Brett after he'd had this great match, but Sean was on commentary despite the fact that he had this knee injury, which his own doctor had diagnosed, but nobody else did. Does that show that Vince favoured Sean over Brett at this time?
Oh God, yeah. I mean, like we said, this is sort of, you know, Brett isn't aware of obviously what's happening here. That the sort of twatty Brett, sort of whiny Brett, is, you know, everybody wants to see him fail because Vince wants to see him fail, effectively. But no one ever talks about Undertaker's streak needing Bret Hart. Undertaker only wins this match because Brett gets involved.
Undertaker's streak has one DQ victory due to chloroform, has Bret Hart's help, has... It's not a great streak. We talk about, oh, it's fantastic, oh, it's legacy, but this is a real myth-busting podcast here, and I'd say there are greater WrestleMania contributors to the canon than Undertaker right now. This match is great because right at the start, JR goes, this will not be a technical masterpiece. And I was like, no shit. Why are you giving this 20 minutes? Sid Vicious, I keep calling him Sid Vicious because that's what I watched him as in WCW. Terrible promo, not great in the ring, not a particularly smart man.
Utterly delusional as well. He was talking just a couple of years ago about how TNA were interested in him, but he felt that he could be main eventing WrestleManias.
Yep. But I cannot look at him without burst out laughing. And also in like the nice, like, huh, yeah, you're entertaining. And he absolutely has a look. Like, has the look of, like, if you went to Vince McMahon that age, describe a main eventer, he would look like Sid Vicious. So it's no wonder he had the belt for 2 months.
But the Undertaker's look was weird in this, wasn't he? Because he was always wearing black, but then was wearing grey knee-length socks and grey gardening gloves, effectively, which I don't think is funeral attire. If I was Barry McMahon, I wouldn't expect someone at the Undertaker's home to look like that.
You'd expect him to look like Paul Bearer, wouldn't you?
Anyone of my friends that die, I'm getting you someone that looks like Paul Bearer at your funeral. Stop me. Try to stop me. You're already dead.
Well, we've only talked about two matches, but goodness me, we've really gone deep into both of them. Let's have a break. Parts Unknown will continue next.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
All right, next we're going to talk about a couple of blue chippers who might go on to have a future in the business. Rocky Maivia, a.k.a. The Rock, at this stage he's The Pebble, up against The Sultan, his cousin Rikishi, for the IC title. Rocky's Mania debut, they give him the big build-up on commentary. He's got white boots on. Honky Tonk Man is on commentary, so it must be important. Not a bad match. It's got some of the classic Rock stuff, the kip-up, the classic Rock punches.
We need to start with a revelation that happened just before we started recording.
Carl, you didn't know that the Sultan was Rikishi, is that right?
I did not know. I had no idea.
Cleverly disguised here, in fairness.
I mostly know Rikishi from his backside, so... He didn't quite have the heft and gravitas that it later would have in later years. Honky Tonk is... Oh, God, shut that boring old fart up.
How is Honky Tonk a thing 20 years after Elvis is dead? How has no one just gone... This is a gimmick that should have died a long time ago. This should have died on the toilet.
It feels like a favour, doesn't it? Let's let the old fella come out and just talk some rubbish for a bit.
Bob Backlund and the Iron Sheik were there as well. It's nice.
Sheik, quite good as a outside the ring manager. Because he really, if you watch him close, he's really instructing the Sultan to do stuff. I'm not sure if because he's a great manager or if because he genuinely thinks he can control the Sultan.
He's
got a very potty mouth Twitter account.
So The Rock wins this match. The Rock wins this match with a roll-up, so he's the IC champ. Then he starts doing a post-match interview with JR, but he's immediately attacked by the Sultan, the Sheik, and Backlund, who beat him down until Rocky Johnson, his dad, comes in and makes the save. Lovely Mania moment, but then they both get beaten up as well. Interesting, Rocky Johnson, High Chief Peter Maivia, and now The Rock's daughter, we are told, has just started training at the Performance Center, so there could be a fourth generation of Rock coming to a ring near you soon, which would be quite something.
Fantastic. Would be the first four times. So at this, during this match, The Rock is being referred to as the first third generation superstar, which is great. Amazing.
She's only 17, though. So
yeah, she's not going to be in the Mae Young Classic anytime soon or anything like that. But, you know, she will probably be fast-tracked beyond her abilities, as was Rocky Maivia at this stage, lest we forget he's, you know, the IC champ. He was very, very hated despite being a face. So that's young Rocky. What about young Triple H? Hunter Hearst Helmsley and China backstage with handsome Doc Hendricks before the match with Goldust and Marlena. And Tripp's voice ludicrously high, like they're in a room filled with helium. Vince laughs at a sign in the crowd as they make their way down to the ring that says, "Hunter, who wears the trousers in your house? Lawler, when China was born, she was so ugly she was breastfed by her father. I think they filmed Gorillas in the Mist in China's shower." If you wonder why we give Jerry Lawler so much stick on this podcast, I think there's a couple of nice examples as to exactly why. Vince, somebody who famously hates smoking, was big on Marlena smoking a cigar during the match, which 15-year-old me thought was incredibly hot. They were a legit married couple, of course, those two.
Yeah.
Goldust, not Vince and Marlena.
Vince and Marlena, with yeah. Marlena and the cigar.
I was really impressed by young Goldust. I love young Goldust and think that there is an alternate universe where we talk of Goldust and the character of Goldust in the same way we talk about The Undertaker. Because he had it, in-ring stuff, great promos, like the entrance with the Shattered Dream Productions. It was all there, just Undertaker was 6'10".
Great chemistry, these two, in the ring.
Mm.
Yeah, I thought when Goldust was on top early, it was a lot of fun, and then it gets a bit slower and it gets, you know, starts wading through treacle. But yeah, these two clearly did bounce off each other, and I'm still trying to get over your cigar thing. Do you really like the cigar thing?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
No. I can just imagine Vince being in the strip club you mentioned last week and going, "I want that gimmick."
Carrie, lest we forget that Trips had won the coveted Slammy for Best Hair Day the night before, so he went into this with some real momentum.
Absolutely. And yet again, he needed China's interference for distraction to actually get the win. Hunter Hearst Helmsley, Triple H, in Mania in general, not that great, is he?
No, not particularly. We've thrown a lot of love China's way, rightfully so, over the last couple of weeks. I think we ought to give Marlena, who you might know better as Terry Runnels, some credit for the fact that she just got absolutely destroyed by China.
Did, yeah.
And she took it like a pro, and it looked really good. She was tossed around and like ragdolled all over the place, and it was very, very effective.
It really was. It looked pretty real, didn't it? I thought she was excellent. Nice little interlude, this one.
Surprisingly tender finish as well, Goldust carrying Marlena back. I felt there's a bit where he cradles Marlena in the middle of the ring. I went, "Oh no, wrestling goes a bit too far." In kayfabe, like, wow, there's more to titles and wins and losses, and a man's wife has just been hurt.
That was that for the singles matches on the card. In terms of the tag title match, it was Owen and the British Bulldog up against Vader and Mankind. Paul Bearer, the heel's manager, which means Foley's the only person still alive in the match. Foley unhappy at this point. He was offered a match with Mark Mero on the card, but said he'd rather not be on WrestleMania if that was what he was offered. Poor old Mero, can't catch a break. JR tries to interview Bulldog on the way to the ring. Owen wasn't keen because the thing was, Owen had said, "I'm the leader of this team," and they were trying to get some dissension between them. But that is a thing that I can't remember them ever using that, interviewing somebody on the way to the ring.
It's weird. My first note is, why is JR stirring shit? Why is he doing that? You know, that's just utterly bizarre. It's like, you know, sort of a batsman coming out before a big match going, disappointed you're not captain, mate. I'm about to go and what are you doing? Utterly bizarre. And then JR runs back and calls the match. I didn't really get that, but it was, you know, I quite enjoyed it because it was, I didn't see it coming.
I mean, doing the two slammies bit as well at this point, which is a great part of his gimmick. But you look at this match and Vader, who was brilliant in WCW and really, really bad in WWF for some reason, you can almost see him being carried around the match by Owen Hart. You've got Bulldog, who's like ridiculously roided up at this point, to the point that it's almost strange that nobody said, just tone it down a notch, please. But Owen, again, as we spoke about last week, obviously Foley played his part, but this is the Owen show, I thought.
Oh, yeah. Every time you mention Vader, I've been fist pumping because I freaking love Vader. Like, he was one of my guys. He's an elite super big in the way that we'll never, ever see an elite super big in wrestling ever again.
But do you agree not in the WWF?
No, but that's because Shawn Michaels was terrified of him. Just basically politicked, completely blocked him out of the main event through politics and basically went, nope, Vince, he's not the guy, he's too fat. So Vader famously hates Shawn Michaels. Vader also famously got wrestling banned in Kuwait. But we should be talking about Owen Hart. And Owen Hart absolutely carries this match. Again, he just understands tag team wrestling in a way that, unfortunately, the only other person I can say who understands tag team wrestling like that is another dead wrestler, Eddie Guerrero. In terms of hot tags and spacing. Like, spacing is really interesting when you do tag team wrestling. So how you cut off the channel from your opponent to their partner is something Owen Hart was particularly good at. It was just, if I stand here, you have to get through me to get the tag, which creates such a great dynamic in tag team wrestling matches. And it's not like you get sometimes where it's just I'm a singles guy in a tag match. It's I am wrestling this like I'm a tag team wrestler, which makes everything work so much better. It makes Bulldog better because Bulldog very often needs his hand held doing stuff. It makes Mankind, when Mankind starts doing his weird thing, interesting. It makes Vader and his constant approaches to the top rope that much more interesting because Owen's not looking just at Vader. He's looking at the ring and seeing what route could I get to Bulldog. Owen Hart, man. What a guy.
Anton, I imagine as a kid you were a big British Bulldog fan, as young British wrestling fans were. He was one of the reasons we were drawn to it, not just for his verse on Slam Jam, but his in-ring stuff as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, but then you go back and watch the archetypal British WWF event, SummerSlam 92, and it's heartbreaking to actually go back and watch it. So I actually don't really like watching British Bulldog matches now because I just feel a bit sad and it kind of destroys my youth a little bit, to be honest. Yeah, but I loved him growing up, obviously, but I can't go back and watch them with the same joie de vivre, shall we say. But yeah, as you said, as I said a couple of weeks ago, watching Owen Hart matches with a fresh pair of eyes is wonderful. It's great. I kind of actually just rather have just seen Foley and Owen go at it for this match, to be really honest. The other two didn't really do that much, and the other two just are wonderful. So it's not a bad match. I'm not saying, you know, and Mankind and Vader look like a tag team, which is great. But yeah, it would have been, I'd much rather have just seen the two premier talents go at it.
There's a bit right, I think maybe a third away into the match, where the camera locks on Paul Bearer, and Bearer does a little finger tool. I'm like, wow, that's I want that all the time. Get those three eclectic weirdos in the ring together all the time. In my notes, it does have a special note about just how it's quite sad that Mick Foley's the only person still with us. But wrestling.
Double count out finish, Kerry, which is a bit unsatisfying, really. Did that take much away from the match for you?
Not really. I mean, I'm not a fan of that kind of hokey finish. But no, I loved this match. I really did. And you're right that Bulldog looks like he's going to burst at any point if he takes a bump too hard. But I should say, Anton, saying about watching SummerSlam 92 makes him feel like he's lost his youth. I actually do a lecture for my students where I'm talking about the way that nationality and country is portrayed in WWE. Sorry, I am going to get back into the point soon. And I can show these kids who were born in, like, 1998, a picture of the British Bulldog, and they know who he is. British Bulldog and his image transcends generation. You have no reason to feel bad about it. So there you go.
Thanks. I like that.
Let's go right back to the start of the show. A four-way elimination tag match. The Headbangers versus Furnace and Lafon, the Godwins and the New Blackjacks, with the winner getting a shot at the tag champs the next night on Raw rather than actually on WrestleMania. Nice Mania botch here, as the graphic says, Headbangers as Furnace and Lafon come down to the ring. You do feel some sympathy for the guy doing the Astons, the little straps that say people's name. I mean, who were Furnace and Lafon? Just two guys who were also on this show. The Blackjacks, old and new. I mean, my big takeaway from this is Bradshaw's moustache.
And that is why I cackled.
It's something that would have got him into YMCA.
They are incredibly homoerotic at this time, and I am loving it.
The chaps are something special as well, aren't they?
Oh yeah, it's a great look.
Do you think he just watched a bunch of Village People videos and said this is how we update the old Blackjacks and make them the new Blackjacks?
There is no way that Bradshaw knows that's homoerotic, though.
No, that's
there's no way
there's
he
no
knows.
Way he wouldn't have signed
he
up.
He wouldn't
for
have
it.
Agreed.
The Blackjacks get eliminated with Bradshaw pushing the ref. Furnace and Lafon get counted out. I mean, it's like they sort of on the morning of the show went, oh man, we said that we were going to do this match, didn't we? What eliminate one, count one out, Headbangers win.
Yeah, they woke up in Vince's strip club and they're like, oh, what did we say? Like, what did we do last night? What did we promise?
We booked Furnace and Lafon on WrestleMania.
Who and what are the Godwins?
Who are the Godwins?
Oh, so you weren't familiar with the Don't Go Messing With The Country Boy Godwins. Hillbilly Jim and who was the... Oh, no, Henry and Phineas and Hillbilly Jim was the manager, right?
That's
and
right.
They carried a slop bucket to the ring. And when Triple H had been naughty once, he was in like a hog pen match. Yeah, and he got poo all over him because of it.
Galvanised buckets.
And yeah. That is why we needed the Attitude Era.
JR barely says a word in this match. It's all Vince. It's almost as though Vince has gone, yeah, this is my fault. I've got this boy. Sorry, I'll justify this.
And what's the one phrase that Vince repeats more than any other?
Is it sorry?
It's it's that and what a manoeuvre!
What a manoeuvre!
He was a terrible commentator, wasn't he? Why
he really
did he keep
was.
Doing it for so long?
I don't know.
Because Vince.
It was his business. His business, and he wanted to show everyone else how it's done. And yeah, in a way, he's still doing it in Michael Cole's ear.
Okay, we've only got one more match to discuss, and it's Ahmed Johnson and the Legion of Doom beating the Nation of Domination, who were, at this point, Crush, Farouk and Savio Vega. This was a Chicago street fight, which featured everything, including the kitchen sink. They kept saying that. Nation loosely based on the Nation of Islam, any means necessary, that was the kind of thing, which made Ahmed the Martin Luther King, except his mic skills not quite as good as the doctor's. Ahmed also always had problems with his trunks. He wore knee and thigh shin protectors, which he offsets here with his LOD gear. He was really rubbish. The backstory to this, Carl, do you know, this is kind of, we're in that period between where you know and don't know stuff about wrestling. What's your Nation of Domination history?
Oh,
knowledge?
Man, I love me some Nation of Domination. It's Farouk.
Ron Simmons,
otherwise the very first black NWA / WCW champion, comes over to WWE, isn't really going anywhere. They need to refresh, create this Nation of Domination gimmick, which is basically Nation of Islam. You've got people dressed up as Stokely Carmichael / also known as Kwame Ture. I love the Nation of Domination because obviously it's a conglomerate of black people just going, screw all of you, we're going to beat up everyone. Has loads of, dips their toe in loads hip-hop culture as well, so that's why you have white rap boy rappers in the corner with Nation baseball caps and whatnot supporting
JC Ice and Wolfie D, for
yes.
Those who don't know their name. They wrapped them to the ring. They also had this lawyer based on Johnny Cochran, didn't they? Clarence Mason, who had been brought in by Jim Cornette a couple of months earlier. He was later fired by Farouk. He actually quit because he was uncomfortable with the racial angle of the Nation. Was it racist?
Yeah, I mean, it's discriminatory based on race. You're putting all the black people together in a gimmick where they are mostly regarded as heels.
But as you say, it had Owen Hart in it. It had Savio Vega in it. Owen Hart came later, but Savio Vega in one of DOA.
Crush.
Crush was in it for a bit, wasn't he?
Crush is wrestling in this match.
And they all split up and then would form their own factions, DOA and Los Barriquas, and they all feuded and stuff.
It's one of those things where it probably is racist because Nation of Domination was always depicted as bad guys. And whenever Nation of Domination got on the mic and quite rightfully went, here are the racial inequalities in the United States and you should be fearful, well, they shouldn't say. And this is why black people were aggrieved. They were booed by a large section of the crowd. But it's really cool to see that visual. And there are so many times where the Nation of Domination would come out and raise the black fist where my eyeballs would widen and go, yes, that is something I'm interested in.
Ahmed Johnson was hung in this match.
He was, because the feud was...
That's a bit near the knuckle, isn't it?
It's not even near. It's way past the line. Because the feud was kind of like, Ahmed Johnson, you're not a real black man because you're rejecting the Nation. Which, again, is... It plays into that very, very awkward space of what black people can and can't do and what their politics can and can't be and whether or not if you reject this form of black viewpoint, you are an Uncle Tom or a coon. And portraying the Nation throughout constantly as the heel group is interesting. And you can, you know, you want to throw a stone way into the future. You see the New Day and how when the New Day first debuted, we're three black people and we're like laughing and smiling and we're doing church stuff, which I was more offended by that than I was by the Nation. And then the New Day eventually changed and went, if we don't clap, we'll snap. And then eventually the New Day are what they are now, which is we're just black people who are allowed to have fun, which is something that very few black people are allowed to do freely in media, which is really, really interesting. So to sum up your question, were the Nation of Domination racist? Probably, but I don't care because it was a whole bunch of black people doing stuff in a way I don't get to see on TV much.
The noose spot to me suggested they went, should we tar and feather him? No, that's too far. So let's get the noose out, shall we? Let's, you know, as in that's going to be okay. It felt very odd.
I love this match.
I was just about to say, what a horrible garbage wrestling match this was.
Oh, no, I love it.
Very much to your taste.
Oh, I love it. It's absolute chaos. It's Nation of Domination, who are just... I really like it when a stable or group come to the ring and just start destroying everything. Just like, we're an oncoming force and we cannot be reasoned with. We're just going to do this. So the Nation of Domination doing, going, we're a bunch of black people just going to go off and do this. And then you get LOD, which I love already, just going, no, we're also a weird oncoming force. I'm going to do this from a right angle. And having them clash and throw things at each other and put each other through tables for 10, 15 minutes of rank stupidity that means absolutely nothing in the long run. Yeah, plug me in, baby.
This is before hardcore, this is before ECW and that kind of thing. So they haven't quite perfected the hardcore element. They haven't perfected the weapons and the outside of the ring. So the camera work's a mess. Oh, you can't keep up with anything. Like you said, it ultimately doesn't matter. There's the final shot with the 2x4 to the chest is just a mess.
The interesting thing is Ahmed Johnson is past the 2x4 by a Nation of Domination member. I swear, what? And in my notes, it was by one of the white people in Nation Domination. You passed 2x4, so my notes just said, "Shake my head." It's always the allies that let down the political course.
and then more silliness after this. So it's just there's just more. It's just carnage, and it strikes me as a kind of before the era of actually we get used to this stuff and we get better choreographed weapon matches, shall we say?
Gary, this is right in your wheelhouse, this kind of match. You must have loved it.
Yeah, not so much. No, this, yeah. I can see why Carl likes it. I can certainly see the chaos appealing to Carl's crazy mind. But, yeah, it makes no sense. It makes no sense.
Exactly. It makes no sense. I was so sports entertained.
It also doesn't surprise me. So you've just had the most amazing match. So this comes on after Stone Cold Bret Hart. And then Bret Hart obviously comes out for the next match because he's just watched this and gone, this is everything I hate!
That's what I was telling you before! All right, so overall, one iconic match, one quite nice tag match, rest of it, could take it or leave it.
Yeah, common factor in the matches that I liked being the Hart family.
You got a WrestleMania moment?
Am I allowed to say all of Austin Hart?
Go on then.
Okay, or it could just be the image as kind of Austin is lying there in a pool of his own blood. And that comes from me, and I hate bleeding in matches, but it is just an amazing moment.
Carl?
Nation of Domination, given the raised black fist, and then watching a largely white crowd do it at the same time. It's like, yes!
Anton?
Shamrock cycling shorts. That boy's got thighs.
I'm going to go for the Sultan's Jester boots. Pretty special. Next week, we're in Anaheim for WrestleMania 12, the Ultimate Warrior squashing Triple H, Roddy Piper versus Goldust in a Hollywood backlot brawl, and a 60-minute Iron Man match between Sean and Brett. Anton, where can people keep up with you? Via the medium of social media.
At Sky Anton.
And Carl.
Anchorman 616.
And Carrie.
At Carrie Sparkle.
We are at the PU Podcast. I am at MJDAFC. Please share, subscribe, give us a nice rating, all that stuff. If you know someone who likes WrestleManias, tell them about us. I've been Matt Davis Adams. You've been in Parts Unknown.
The Parts Unknown Wrestling Podcast is a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.